Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, my name is Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. It's good to be here.
And today we're going to be doing one of our regular Q&A episodes where we take questions from listeners and we look at little news stories and work through a few different things. We're going to be coming to a question from a listener later on, but first up, we wanted to look at some interesting statistics that have come out of the United States. We've been talking about abortion on and off over the last few years, but particularly since the Roe versus Wade legal ruling was overturned by the Supreme Court momentously in 2022, which enabled states for the first time for 50 years, if they wish to ban abortion entirely or to significantly restrict its access, which a number of states have done. And yet, figures from the Guttmacher, am I saying that right, Dad? Guttmacher Institute?
That's right. And again, a health warning, because the Guttmacher Institute is known to be a pro-choice, pro-abortion institute, but nonetheless, it produces very detailed statistics, which by and large are regarded as accurate and reliable.
Yes. So the Guttmacher Institute, which is a US kind of policy institute about abortion and reproductive health, has done its study for 2023, and they estimate that despite the bans, the total number of abortions in the United States actually increased. In 2023, their figures show that there was an estimated 1,026,690 abortions within the formal healthcare system in 2023, which is the first full calendar year after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. This is a rate of 15.7 abortions per 1,000 women of reproductive age, and it is, interestingly, a 10% increase since 2020, which is the last year for which they had comprehensive estimates. What do we take from this, Dad?
Well, it's a very painful story, but I hate to be able to be in the position of the one who says "told you so." But you know, for years I have been arguing, and not as many of other people have, that the law is a very blunt instrument when it comes to influencing abortion, and that the issue is not to make abortion illegal, but the issue is to make abortion unthinkable. And although the change in the law, which effectively abortion was banned or made extremely difficult in a number of states in the USA, that was presented by many people who are opposed to abortion as a wonderful triumph and advance, and something that they've been aiming to do politically for decades. At the time, the question was, yes, but if the demand for abortion is there and is continuing, is making something illegal actually going to save the lives of unborn babies? And I'm afraid the evidence is, sadly, that it doesn't appear to have had that effect. And that if you look at the graphs, there has been a very significant rise in the number of abortions taking place since about 2018 in the USA. It's interesting because there are similar findings in the statistics in the UK, where we have a very liberal abortion law, And what seems to be happening is that trend to an increase has just continued, despite the fact that abortion has been made legal. So how does that work, Tim? How can it be that abortion is increasing?
Well, there's lots of different theories about this. And as you'd expect, it's hotly contested by the various sides. But the basic idea is, so since the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, there are 14 states that have banned abortion, with sometimes for kind of limited exceptions. And in addition, 7 other states have also restricted their abortion access, so kind of brought down the time limit to typically of gestational age before which abortions are legal. So you have in total 21 of the 50 states in America. You know, prior to 2022, every state was constitutionally obliged to offer some kind of abortion provision. And now 21 either offer none or very limited abortion provision. And you'd think, well, that's almost half the country has no longer has access to abortion. Abortions go down. And the argument goes, well, no, there are just as many women having unplanned pregnancies or unprotected sex, or just the drivers of abortion haven't changed one bit. The demand is there. Simply the supply is being restricted. But what do people do? They jump on a plane, or they jump in a car, or they get on a Greyhound bus, and they travel across state lines to a neighboring state that does still have abortion clinics, and they go and have an abortion there. So the argument goes that actually simply making it illegal in half the country is not going to have any significant impact on the total number of abortions, because people will simply procure them in the states where they're still legal. And a similar thing happens closer to home. You know, for many years, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland had a much more restrictive abortion regime than we did here in England. And what did people do when they wanted an abortion? Many of them jumped on a cheap flight or a ferry across the Irish Sea, came to a UK, to an English clinic, had their abortion, and then went back home. So the argument goes, you know, if you want, unless you make abortion legal everywhere or everywhere within kind of reasonable travel time, it's not going to make much of a difference to the total numbers.
I think there's a further issue, and that is that if you make abortion illegal, and yet there is still a very high demand for abortion, then it's quite likely that some people who, for whatever reason, can't travel out of the state will find some other way of having an abortion. For instance, getting drugs illegally off the internet. And of course, those abortions will not appear in any kind of official statistics.
And the Guttmacher Institute actually note that. They say this is their estimates of, you know, 1 million, just over 1 million abortions in 2023. They say that's almost certainly an undercount, as it only includes those attained within the formal US healthcare system, you know, so at bricks and mortar health facilities or via kind of official virtual providers. But as you say, in the 2020s, I'm sure there are lots of other under the counter backstreet so-called ways of procuring abortions that aren't, no one is counting. So,
and so I think what is so tragic, you know, for us as people who really want to argue that abortion is not an appropriate way, of course, to treat an unplanned pregnancy, that every life is precious, that every life counts, that both lives matter, both the life of the mother and the life of the child, and that therefore we are committed to try to reduce the number of abortions going on. I think what this seems to demonstrate fairly conclusively, that the legal approach is deeply flawed and often can have unanticipated consequences. And therefore, for Christians to put so much effort and concern and energy into the process of battling to have the law changed, does seem to me is just not the main priority. I don't want to imply that the law is not relevant. And of course, here in the UK, we currently have questions about whether the abortion law is going to be changed here. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yes. So, I mean, this kind of ties into the other angle. I'll just start before I get there, is that what we saw in 2022 was that this, what was hailed as an enormous victory, understandably, by lots of pro-lifers who have been working towards getting rid of Roe versus Wade for 50 years in many instances. Clearly, it's been a jolt of energy to lots of those many Christians. But what it's also had is it's been an incredible instigating and energizing factor for the pro-choice side, who have been, you know, predictably horrified, shocked out of the blue. But what it's meant is that actually abortion and the kind of pro-abortion lobby, if it's such as it exists, is now more active, more radical, more urgent than it ever has been in my lifetime, because they feel a sense of threat. And so, you know, what is happening in the States is not just that people are traveling over the borders, but it's that the bordering states that have kept their bans have in some instances made their abortion regimes more liberal in response to the conservative states banning them. But they've also made it much easier for people to access abortion. So they've ramped up things like financial support and other kind of policy changes. So it's not that the kind of liberal states have stood still while the conservative states have banned it. It's that actually conservative states have banned abortion and liberal states, energized by the kind of anger and outrage of the pro-choice movement, have gone in the other direction. And you see something similar happening here in the UK, even though obviously our abortion regime and legal system is completely different to what's happening in the States. But, you know, everything that happens in America washes downstream to British culture, and that's true of abortion politics. And so pro-choice people have been massively energized here in the UK, and we're seeing that overflow now into repeated efforts in the Parliament. So as a number of amendments have been proposed to a current criminal justice bill that's going through Parliament, which would have the effect of decriminalizing abortion. So the current system we have is that in the UK, abortion is technically illegal always, and then there are exceptions, but the exceptions are worded such as that anyone can get an abortion up to 24 weeks for any reason, effectively, and then thereafter you can only have an abortion if the child is deemed to have a severe physical abnormality of some kind. What has been proposed is that there would be abortion would be fully decriminalized up to 24 weeks. So even though people think abortion is legal, it's actually not. It's that it's illegal, but there are certain exceptions. But you still need two doctors to sign it off, and you need to formally state a reason why you are qualified for an abortion before 24 weeks. And it's this that gives the state the power to prosecute women who lie about their gestational age and have abortions after 24 weeks, which is an increasing problem since we brought in pills by post, as we've discussed in previous episodes. So the decriminalization lobby is basically pushing to take abortion out of the criminal justice system entirely and make it solely a medical procedure in which the courts and the police and the prosecution service have no interest or say. And what this would have, the fear from the pro-life side is that this would have the effect of basically making it open season, because if you can get pills by post and there's no criminal threat hanging over you, you can have an abortion up to term at any point.
That's right. And there are genuine medical concerns, because in order to know at what gestation the pregnancy is, the only reliable way of knowing what stage of the pregnancy you are is to have an ultrasound scan. Many people, their dates when they last had a period and so on is quite an unreliable guide to the level of maturity of the pregnancy. And in the UK, at the moment, because of the so-called pills by post scheme, provided you tell the abortion clinic that you're less than 10 weeks gestation, that will be accepted, and the pills will be sent through the post. If you're more than 10 weeks gestation, you have to go to the clinic and you have to have a scan in order to determine precisely the gestation age of the baby. In a decriminalization, those procedures, effectively, they can be recommended, but people are completely free to do whatever they wish. And therefore, there is a rather nightmarish prospect of women thinking them or persuading themselves that they're still at an early stage of pregnancy, obtaining pills, and then delivering a baby at home without supervision. A baby who's born alive, who may be extremely premature, who may be very sick. And, you know, this just seems a really inappropriate way to go. But, you know, underlying all this is this deeply troubling question, which doesn't, it seems to me, again, I think because of the political polarization, neither the pro-choice nor the quotes pro-life lobbies seem to be asking this question. And that is, why is it here in 2024, when we have universal sex education and we have universal access to contraceptions, and in the UK it's free through the NHS, why is it that the rate of abortions is going up? It was always said that once we make universal sex education, once we empower women, once we give them control of their bodies, once we give them access to contraceptions, it's obvious that unplanned pregnancy will be going steadily down. The demand for abortion is going to dry up. And instead, we have something completely inexplicable, which is an increasing rate of unplanned pregnancy and an increasing rate of abortion. And I don't have a good explanation, but it does seem to me that this question, why this is happening, is of vital importance.
I agree. I think it's really tricky to really unpick that. I mean, looking at the graph in the States, you know, there's a graph here on the Guttmacher Institute. We'll put a link to it in the podcast notes that show kind of total number of abortions in the formal healthcare system going all the way back to 1973, which is when Roe versus Wade was first introduced and kind of made it a constitutional right in all 50 states. You know, it shoots up unexpectedly from, you know, about 700,000 a year up to more than doubling up to what, about 1.6 million a year by 1980. And then it sits there very stable throughout the whole of the 80s, 1.6 million a year. But then from the year about 1990, there has been an absolutely relentless steady decline, and it has almost gone all the way back. It's now, you know, down to under a million, and total numbers by about 2018 or so were down at about 900,000. So significant drop, about more than a 50% drop from its peak of 1.6 million. And you know, this was the kind of story of the quiet victory of the pro-life movement, or they would claim at least, was that, you know, in my lifetime, I was born in 1990, that abortions have been quietly decreasing. And, you know, I used to read stories about how, you know, we're looking forward to the first, like, post-abortion generation in the States, and, you know, young people are increasingly turning against it and all this stuff. And then it stops. And in 2018, you know, almost 30 years of relentless decline stops, and it starts to tick up again in 19, in 20, and even higher in 2023. And that is despite, in the interim, you know, 21 of the 50 states making abortion illegal or much harder to access. So there's a really confusing, concerning story here about a kind of massive change in the historical trends that I haven't really seen anyone able to explain fully yet.
Yeah, and in the UK, it's not quite so dramatic as that, in that basically there was a minor decline taking place from about 2000 onwards. But there has been, a very marked rise in the last few years. And we are still waiting for full figures from the time of the pandemic, which is really outrageous that... the excuse is it's been difficult to analyze the data. But in the UK, we still don't have reliable abortion figures for the last two or three years. But the
numbers we do have, you know, I've found the preliminary numbers here, and you can see that in the UK, abortions fall to just over 200,000 by about kind of 2013-14. And they sit there at 200,000 for a while. But then again, around 2017-18, they start to tick up again. And we're now back up to 200. And in 2021, the figure I can hear is 228,000. I don't know if that's preliminary or if it needs to be properly increased. But so something is happening in kind of Western countries. We'd have to look at some other states. But something is happening here where, you know, a generation or two after abortion was introduced, as you say, a generation after we've had widespread sex education understanding, women are increasingly still falling pregnant and not wanting to continue those pregnancies in greater numbers than they were before, and that is puzzling.
So I've heard two possible explanations, both of which have some credibility. The first is that there have been scares about oral contraception. There's increasing concern from young women.
Yes.
That oral contraception may have side effects, particularly with cancer and other side effects, and therefore more women are reluctant to put themselves long-term onto the oral contraceptive pill. What we do know is that the hormonal contraceptives are far more reliable than other methods, such as barrier methods.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's been a move away from hormonal contraception, that may be one factor, meaning that there are more unplanned pregnancies. But the other fascinating suggestion is that in some sense, this reflects deaths of despair. In other words, that young people in particular are feeling, I don't want to bring a child into the world. I mean, what kind of world am I bringing a newborn baby into? You know, a world of Gaza and Ukraine and cost of living crisis and then climate change. We're all doomed anyway. The world's going to burn. Why bring a child into the world? What a terrible thing to do. And therefore, if I happen to find myself pregnant, surely abortion is the caring, the intelligent, the compassionate thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's very hard to know, isn't it? It's certainly true that idea that, you know, it is unethical to have children at a time like this, as odd as it might sound, is certainly not uncommon among kind of my generation, I would say, particularly outside of the church. It's hard to know how much that could be feeding into abortion statistics, isn't it? But also, I think your first point is certainly anecdotally rings true to me that, again, in my generation, women are much more suspicious of hormonal contraception, or at least more alert and concerned by the side effects, which I think have always been there. But I think maybe earlier generations just accepted them as like, this is the price you pay. Whereas I think women in their 20s and 30s today are much less, ironically, because I think it's taken for granted, they're much less willing to accept the miracle of oral contraception and take all the sometimes unpleasant hormonal side effects. And there's more interest in, you know, there are apps you can get which, you know, claim to be able to, you know, we'll just measure your temperature and we'll tell you when you're in your ovulation window and you can just avoid sex then. And that's the natural way. And that kind of goes in, I think, with a general tilt in popular culture towards, like, you know, let's be more natural. Let's not use artificial things and chemicals and stuff like that. It's don't mess with your hormones. Just do things the kind of natural way. However, spurious that might be. So I certainly can believe that's part of the story.
It reminds me, I'm sorry to lower the tone, but it reminds me of a joke that used to be about natural fertility, you know, people who use natural contraception. You know, what do you call someone who uses the natural fertility method to stop getting pregnant? Answer, a parent. Because basically it doesn't work, or at least it's certainly not as reliable as the contraceptive pill. And therefore, you may be right that people are using some flashy AI rhythm detector in order to try and avoid getting pregnant. I mean, again, sadly, what this suggests, doesn't it, is that people are less reluctant to use these contraceptives, but their sexual practices remain unchanged. In other words, they're having as much promiscuous sexual intercourse, one suspects, or, you know, intercourse outside of settled relationships. Is that the case? I mean, you would expect that if people were more concerned about getting pregnant, they would restrict their sexual activities, and clearly that isn't the case.
Well, there is interesting data that suggests that younger people are having sex less. This is teenagers. That is true. Alongside, they generally partake of risky, so-called kind of risky social behaviors less, and that's true about drug taking and alcohol as well. There's a lot of different theories about why that is. A big one is the growth of the internet, and that people are spending much more time indoors by themselves, socializing through a screen, with all its associated downsides, looking at internet porn. But one of the few upsides is that you can't get pregnant from watching porn. So there is that. I suspect that is the case, but having no idea of the data, I would guess that once you get into your 20s and 30s and people are actually in relationships, even if not kind of long-term settled marriage style relationships, people are having sex as much as they ever were. So I think there's probably less sex at teenage level because we're doing, you know, people spending less time in bars and nightclubs with the opposite gender. But I think once people are in relationships, I think they're having as much sex as they ever were.
So that's an empirical question then for an investigative journalist. And that is the abortion rate, the increase in abortion rate should not be seen in the younger generation. It should be seen in the older. In the older. And that would be an interesting...
That would be an interesting thing
That would
find
be in
out.
The data somewhere.
Oh, we'll get back to you on that one. We'll try and find out.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Shall we move on to another topic, something completely different, as they used to say in Monty Python? This is a question from a listener called Lydia. And Lydia writes, any thoughts on ultra-processed food from a Christian perspective? Is our church food culture healthy? It touches on other areas of life, such as how we use our time and money. Lydia writes that she probably spends more time than most on food, as she makes lots of meals from scratch, as well as baking her own bread. It's much more filling, nutritious, but it does take a bit of time. I think of some of my wonderful sisters in Christ who do so much for church and are regularly throwing their homes open and feeding lots of mouths. There's no way they could do all that while making things from scratch. I sometimes wonder if I'm getting my priorities right.
Okay, Tim, you are the foodie between us, and therefore I will bang it back to you.
Well, I have to declare an interest in which I also make my own bread. I have literally just come onto this podcast from stretching my sourdough loaf. It's currently...
You're the ultimate man, Tim.
Fermenting away in the kitchen downstairs. And I also, as you say, I'm a bit of a foodie. We do make a lot of food from scratch. I think this is a really interesting question. Ultra-processed food, as we kind of mentioned alluded to in our previous episode about the new wave of obesity drugs, is a growing problem, I think. And in kind of industrialized agriculture in general, and the kind of modern food industry is increasingly detached from how food kind of could or should be grown in the ideal kind of healthy, nutritious way. And people do get loads and loads of their calories from incredibly kind of processed, artificialized food. That said, I think there is a lot of excessive kind of scaremongering or sensationalism around this topic. And it ties into our previous conversation. You know, we live in a moment in which everything which is quote unquote natural is deemed to be superior to that which is quote unquote artificial. And certainly there are certain types of hyper satiable, very high in sugar and salt and fat, ultra processed foods, which are just objectively not very good for us and should be eaten very rarely. They don't fill us up. They give us kind of empty calories and they're not nutritious.
So just to unpack this, so the theory goes that one of the primary reasons behind this massive rise in obesity, which we're seeing across the world, is it isn't that human self-control has plummeted over the last 20 years. It's to do with the manufacturers who produce these foods, which are programmed. They're very, very sophisticated. They have lots and lots of additives, and they're programmed to tap directly into our reward centers. They've been honed down so that this food just it tastes overwhelmingly delicious. But in particular, we just want to keep eating it. We want it. Yeah. We just want more and more and more. And so
sometimes called hypersatiable foods,
right?
You know, that don't exist in nature because they combine an absurd amount of sugar and salt and fat, and those three things never come together in nature. And so we're kind of our kind of lizard, animal, reptile brains can't handle it, and we're just like more.
And obviously, this is driven by capitalism and by, you know, industrial food production. And I think that story is very strong. Medically, you know, the evidence is increasing to accumulate that this is one of the primary factors behind the growth of obesity. And therefore, from a medical point of view, I think there are reasons to feel that this very ultra-processed kind of food, which is, you know, you walk into any kind of shop, supermarket, and you're just bombarded with these very attractive, brightly colored packaging, all of which is, you know, enticing you to eat this kind of food. But that doesn't mean, I mean, there is a class issue here, isn't there, Tim, which we need to draw out.
Definitely. And so I think firstly, what I'd say is, while that is all true, sometimes people take this kind of simplistic reductionist idea too far. And so they say, you know, is a can of chopped tomatoes processed food? Well, yes, technically it's been processed in a factory. But it is also just tomatoes in tomato juice in a can so that it lasts forever. And as long as the manufacturer hasn't thrown in lots of additional salt and sugar, it's actually not something that you should necessarily be worried about. And, you know, I cook meals include cans of chopped tomatoes all the time, and I don't think that makes them super unhealthy. So I think we need to be a bit more nuanced about it. And also, it's easy to look at, you know, go into the fruit and veg aisle and say, gosh, what a wonderful bit of God's bounteous creation. We're just eating natural like we were when we were kind of peasants off the land. And it's like, well, no, everything that you see in supermarkets has also been grown by an industrial food manufacturer. And it might, you know, it might not be wrapped up in plastic or, you know, have a jazzy kind of branding like a Pop-Tart, but even, you know, all our modern fruits and vegetables are the product of human planning, engineering, and modern industrial agriculture. They don't exist in nature in that form. You know, we've spent thousands of years carefully cultivating and interfering in the genetic evolution of these food substances to make them more palatable and more tasty. So let's not go overboard on what is natural and what is artificial. But what is certainly the case is that food cultures in the church, I believe, kind of closely follow along with class. And so because most people in the Christian church in the UK, at least, are from a middle class background, I think they tend to eat in a more middle class way, as I do, you know, making food from fresh food from scratch. You know, not everyone bakes their own bread, of course, but, you know, maybe eating more kind of less processed sliced white loaves and having more kind of artisanal bowls and all that kind of stuff, and doing less kind of ready meals and processed food. And, you know, I eat that way. I like that way. I think that's healthier and good for you. But we have to acknowledge that it's more expensive in many instances. And this particularly comes home in my context because the church that we go to is in a relatively kind of deprived working class area. And every 4 weeks, once a month, we do a thing where people do like a bring and share dinner. Because our church service is in the afternoon, immediately after church, and we all put out food on the table and eat together, which is a really nice thing. But it is fascinating to see the distinction between the types of food we bring to these bring and share meals compared to our brothers and sisters from a kind of more working class background, in that we're bringing, you know, fresh bread and salads and charcuteries and hummus and crudités and things like that. And people in the church from other backgrounds are bringing, you know, mini scotch eggs and sausage rolls and bags of crisps and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think it's, you know, I'll be lying if I said I didn't prefer to eat my kind of food, but I think we need to just be careful that we're not, as Christians, engaging in this conversation around food and unintentionally kind of baptizing our middle class preferences and calling that moral or somehow more virtuous or more Christian, when really it's been driven not by any sense of deep scripture and the leading of the Spirit, but simply because we're middle class people who like to shop at Waitrose.
Yeah, so it's complicated, isn't it? And I think that trying to recognise these class differences, but at the same time, helping people to, you know, particularly parents with young children, how to feed children in a healthy way, in a healthy diet. Mm. I mean, one of the things that I find interesting but also painful in our area where we live in North London is that, as you know, it's a very diverse area and we have lots of people from different ethnic communities and many of them from quite socially deprived backgrounds. But when the school comes out at 4 o'clock, I see all these kids who dive straight to the chip shop.
Mm.
And they're eating chips and often chicken wings and tomato ketchup and so on. And this is their standard fare day after day after day after day.
Yeah.
And just thinking, you know, they're setting themselves up for this kind of problems with diet, with and it's a self-perpetuating circle, isn't it? This is the cool, this is the way to eat, this is good food, this is the food I like. Yeah. I like chicken and chips, and I'm going to.
This is what my parents eat. This is what my parents fed me.
Yeah,
and this is you know, sadly why obesity and general ill health, you know, very strongly correlates with levels of deprivation, because it is factually cheaper to get your calories through a very cheap box of chicken and chips than it is to cook a fresh meal from scratch. And I know there's loads and loads of kind of cookbooks out there saying, here's how you can feed a family on 45p with only fresh ingredients. But it's also the question of time, right? Yeah, people who are poorer or from more deprived backgrounds, often parents are working multiple jobs. They don't have 2 hours to do a kind of slow cooker stew in the evening. They need to get food on the table into their children's tummies in 15 minutes before they go out to their next job, or because they have to have other caring responsibilities. So I think it's a complicated one, because I would love the church to be kind of modeling a really healthy food culture, because food is a massive part of like Christian hospitality, as Lydia mentions in her thing. You know, we and lots of churches, you know, our fundamental sacrament is a meal, right? It's bread and wine. Like, how I'd love the church to be modeling a positive approach to food and maybe pushing back on some of the unhealthy sides of modern food culture, but not in a way which was kind of exclusionary to people, because our church is already far too middle class, and if it becomes a space in which you're only welcome if you bake your own focaccia and cook, you know, salmon on croute from scratch every night, then I think that would be a kind of missional pastoral disaster.
Yeah, so in other words, I think we agree that it's more important that we eat together.
Yeah.
Because as you say, eating together is such a Christian instinct. It's a social instinct, isn't it? And breaking bread together, I love it when churches do that. But it's important that we don't put our class spectacles and preferences on. It's more important that we eat together than we eat the very best food.
Yeah, and we had this really come to home when we first moved to this church, and we started, you know, hosting a home group at our house, which would occasionally include food. And we kind of learned quite quickly that if we just produce the food that me and Jesse on a weekday, that would be really unwelcoming and inhospitable to some members of our home group, because they literally just don't eat that food. And as much as I might feel deep in my heart, well, it's nicer and tastier and better, it's more important that the meal before we group gather to study the Bible and pray together is a relaxed form of welcome and hospitality and fellowship. And so we had to be a bit more thoughtful and creative about what we offered people, and maybe buying ingredients and doing food that we don't eat very often at home, but it is food actually which is going to really put people at ease and make them feel that they are truly like welcome as they are. They can bring their full selves into this church community, into this context. They don't have to put on their smart clothes and dress up for Jesus. They can be their natural real selves, and that includes what food we eat. Well, that's probably all I've got on food culture and church. Thanks, Lydia, for throwing us an unexpected question, but I think hopefully it pulled out some interesting thoughts. Please do carry on sending in your questions. We love to hear these curveballs and and your own comments, your feedback. If you disagree with us, we're really open to hearing why and maybe picking up this conversation or other conversations again in a later episode. So please do keep emailing in MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. There's always lots to get your juices flowing in an intellectual sense on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And otherwise, we'll be back with another episode next week. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.